Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with the one and only...
Paul Schrader.
The screenwriter of many classic Hollywood legendary movies, as well as the writer and director of the new, very intriguing, awesome little movie, First Reform, starring Ethan Hawke. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
You're welcome.
I want to open by saying that I really enjoyed your choice there, the final song choice of Leaning. Was that a conscious reference to Night of the Hunter with Robert Mitchum?
No, actually, it was a conscious reference to George Beverly Shea, who was the primary singer for the Billy Graham Crusade, and who I was raised on. That song, my father would play it over and over again, so that's where it came in.
Awesome. And talk about sort of the meaning behind that in Final Embrace, obviously. Ethan, both of them are dealing with loss to some extent, right? Ethan Hawke's character, the priest, has buried a son due to war. Amanda Seyfried's character has also, not to spoil anything, but, is also dealing with loss in her life over tragedy, suicide, depression. What does that final embrace entail to you? Is that both of them, not only romantically, but on a deeper level, of them overcoming their respective losses?
Well, it is meant to be read in different ways. If you wanted to say, I believe he's dead and he's imagining this, I wouldn't object. If you wanted to say it's a miracle, I wouldn't object. If you want to say it is a redemption, I wouldn't object. In fact, I don't know the answer. It's all those things put together.
I love that. It's beautifully ambiguous in that way. Now, as the camera's circling around them, as a movie buff, I go right to Hitchcock and Vertigo. And I know you wrote, didn't you write Obsession for De Palma, too, which was kind of a takeoff or similar to Vertigo, too, an homage. Is that what you had in mind with the circling camera?
Well, this is a very static film. This is a kind of spiritual film. The camera does not move. It doesn't even pan. It doesn't even tilt, and it just sits there. And it is very passive aggressive. It takes too long to do everything. Then all of a sudden at the end, it jumps like a bird from a cage. And it jumps into this kinetic whirligig of a soul in flight. That's a rather... ponderous way, but that's...
I'm all about it. So is it what draws you to that static camera? I mean, it's like it can work. We've seen like Ozu do it in the Japanese films. We've seen Jarmusch do it. But what draws you to it? Is it just allowing us, the audience, to sit patiently and scan the image with our eyes?
Yeah, I mean, I've never used it before. I've always loved camera movement. But when you start working on the spiritual side of the street and the still side of the street, you do have to stretch out time. And one of the ways you do that is with a static camera and with all other withholding devices. And you start fooling around with the viewer's perception of time, and so that they start to have a durational experience rather than a purely kinetic one.
Speaking of camera, I have to drop this in there. My good friend from film school, Steve Tringali, was your first AC on the Canyons. He knows your camera really well, so he says hi. All right, get it back on point. Why cast Ethan? Why was he such an intriguing cast for this role for you? I mean, he's done so many great movies, but why, when you wrote this, were you like, he's the one?
Well, there's a certain physiognomy involved in a troubled man of the cloth. Whether it be Montgomery Clift in I Confess, or Belmondo in Pierre Morin, or Claude Ledoux in Country Priest. And you're thinking about actors who have that physiognomy, maybe Jake Gyllenhaal, maybe Oscar Isaac. But Ethan was 10 years older than them, and his face was getting some very interesting wrinkles. And so I started thinking, I think he's just right for this. And I sent him the script, and he responded right away, and so...
Yeah, awesome. And thematically, did you grow up... I think you grew up in a church that actually had Reformed in the title, obviously, but take me into your own spiritual connection to writing that subject matter.
I'm a product of the Christian Reformed Church in West Michigan, Westside Christian School, Grand Rapids Christian High, Calvin College Seminary. So, I mean, this is this is how my program, my computer was programmed. You know, you don't really get a chance to reprogram yourself.
Right.
So that was my background, and I came to cinema through that background, because I started seeing these films by Bergman, and you were seeing films that were wrestling with the same issues.
Like Winterlight and stuff like that.
Yeah, Through a Glass Darkly was the first one I saw. Yeah. And they're wrestling with the same issues as you are in catechism and in school and so forth.
Awesome. And then in terms of, and to me, I think that makes you, that background makes you interesting position to take on this material because it's fascinating. We have this you know, member of the clergy who's, you know, wrestling with his own things biblically, faith and doubt, like Bergman. But what you bring, interestingly, is tying in the eco-terrorist, the environmental issues. Talk about how that's a fascinating juxtaposition between spirituality and the environment. And I thought it raised a lot of interesting questions of sort of, let's say, maybe even a hypocrisy that you know, if it's God's creation, we should be taking care of it. And so often, right wing is not on that side. So it's an interesting juxtaposition.
Yeah, well, and that's the notion of Christian stewardship, and there is, you know, one character in the movie says he said, you know, we've got to do something. And the character says, well, maybe this is God's plan. He said, what do you mean? It's God's plan to destroy his creation? And the other character says, well, he did once for 40 days and 40 nights. And
it looks like that outside right now. It's raining. One day it's going to wash this gum off these streets.
But, you know, humankind's been having a dialogue for 10,000 years. You know, why are we here? Where are we going? But it was always a hypothetical conversation. You know, you would have it, your kids would have it, and their kids would have it. And there would never be an answer. Well, now, for the first time in the history of the race, it's starting to look like it's maybe not a hypothetical question. Well, that's an intense amount of gravitas. And it has to weigh on everybody, and it starts to define your other types of despair.
Absolutely. And the most striking image that has lingered with me for weeks since I left that theater, you know what I'm going to say, is when he wraps himself in the barbed wire and is about to drink the, what is it, motor oil or something, or fluid?
Drano.
Is that sort of a self-purgation moment? Is that you know, like the thorns on the crown? Is it something like that? Is that him cleansing himself?
It's actually a reference to Flannery O'Connor, Wise Blood, and John Huston, where Hazel Motes, at the end of that book, puts his eyes out with lye and wraps himself up in wire and goes out preaching on the street.
Awesome. But what to Ethan's character, where is he in that moment? He's in despair, and like you said, I guess it's the end could be read as a dream or whatever his last, you know, wish list.
Well, he was going to blow up a church. Yeah. And then this pregnant woman arrives, and he can't do it. And so now he reverts to turning himself into the sacrifice. And this is a pathological fallacy that is deeply embedded in Christianity, the notion of suicidal glory, the notion that my own suffering can make me, can redeem me. It's not what the Bible teaches, it's not what Jesus taught, but it is understandable as a fallacy. Mm-hmm. And it is virtually the same as jihadism, you know. It's the same. It's the same.
That's the extremity part.
Yeah.
Of it. Yeah, you're right. I, of course, watching that part, I mean, he's right on the razor's edge of eco-terrorism at the end. I couldn't help, obviously, think of your masterpiece, Taxi Driver, where, you know, Bickle is Well, yes, he's also holding his hand over Flame too, right? There's a little purgation there too, which I guess Marty also did in Mean Streets with Keitel. Both in Taxi Driver and here, we have a protagonist that come close to committing an act of terror and are ultimately stopped. I guess in De Niro's case, in that it's he just the Secret Service sees him, but he does turn for good at the end, or at least we think, to help the prostitute, Jodie Foster. But in this, it happens the same way too. So what do you think that is? And this is just me, reporter, critic, trying to draw through lines and auteurs and having fun with it. But is there something with you that is fascinating with the idea of living on that, you know, knife's edge where any of us could become a terrorist at any time and our better angels can save us?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have been interested in the pathology of suicidal glory. And I even went to Japan and did a film on Yukio Mishima, who also was afflicted by that, even though he was a successful author. So obviously there's something in my Christian upbringing that keeps drawing me back.
How did, I got to ask you about, one more about Taxi Driver. Is it apocryphal that De Niro came up with you talking to me, like improv in front of the mirror, or was there any semblance of that in the script, and how did you kind of meld those two?
Well, not improv, I mean, but he did come up with it. In the script, it just says he looked at the mirror, he talks to himself, takes out his gun, points it, and he asked me, you know, what does he say? And I said, I'm not sure, you know, make something up. And so he came up with that.
So that's while you guys are on set? He comes and asks you that, or is that like while in pre-production?
No, he gives me a call. I'm in Los Angeles, and he said, you know, it's coming up in a few weeks, that scene, and you know, he wants to ask me what I had in mind.
Awesome. And then one final Marty question. I got to ask you also about Raging Bull, because that final, God, that speech is still, it still rings in my ears. And was it? And though I'm no Olivier, if he fought Sugar Ray, he would say that the thing ain't the ring, it's the play. So give me a stage where the bull here can rage, and though I can fight, I'd much rather recite. That's entertainment. You wrote those words. The hand sitting here fiddling with this coffee cup wrote those words. Memories of that, and I mean, on the one hand, you got to come up with this poetic speech for that movie, for the bookends. On the other hand, he's got to sound kind of punch drunk and like a cheap failure, and that's an amazing all-timer to me.
Well, I hate to burst your bubble.
Burst away.
Jake, the real Jake LaBotta, did in fact have this kind of cabaret show.
That was in the book?
And that was in the book, yeah.
That exact speech?
More or less.
Well, talk about adapting from the book then for Raging Bull. How did you actually take that book and adapt it then? How much of that did Marty help you on, or how much
well,
of that was
I
your
mean,
straight
there was, there was a script that Mark Martin had written, and then Bob asked me to rewrite it. But Jake disliked his brother, Joey, so much that he cut Joey out of his own autobiography. So there is no Joey in the book. And so I started doing research, and I said, oh, this is a sibling story.
That's pretty telling he would cut him out, actually.
And I said, you know, I wasn't interested in boxing. And I said, you know, I said to Marty, you're not interested in boxing. Why do you want to do this? So he said, oh, Bob wants to do it. But once I realized it was a sibling story, not a boxing story, I knew how to write it.
Is it also true you took a crack at Close Encounters as well early on?
Well, I wrote the original script. Yeah. It deviated from that, and I was persuaded not to arbitrate for credit.
Nice. What would be, looking back on it in hindsight, what would be the most rewarding experience, you think, either as a writer or a director? Is there a certain project that really, even if it's an underrated one, no one's really heard about, or something you've directed? And where does First Reformed sort of fit into that?
Well, I think First Reformed is probably that film. You know, there's a lot of gratification. It feels like, you know, things I've been dealing with and thinking about for 50 years have come full circle.
Do you view this sort of as your Bergman-esque, your, like, all the, you know, and then Diary of a Country Priest and Dryer and all that? I mean, is that, it sounds like you really love those and were very inspired by them growing up. Is this your entry in that sort of canon, in that vein?
Yes. Of course, I didn't see them growing up because I saw them as a college student because I didn't see any movies growing up. But it was now a chance to return to the type of movie that was playing when I first fell in love with movies, i.e. when I was in college.
What advice would you have for other up-and-coming writers, screenwriters? I know that's such a broad question, but in terms of First of all, figuring out what stories they want to tell. You've done some great social commentaries, including this, Taxi Driver, all the others. What advice would you be in finding the story that they want to write?
The first advice is that if you can find any modicum of happiness doing anything else, do it. And the second is be fearless. Be fearless. There's a lot of cunning is also involved and a lot of luck, but the only way you find out is by trying.
Now, you also did, you were in my shoes at one point as a film critic back in the day, too, and you knew Pauline Kael, too, the great Pauline Kael. I think she read one time that she would never, she said that she, would never see a movie twice. She got it once. As much as I love her and I'm a legend in the industry, I kind of disagree. I think that sometimes, you can get a sense whether it's a great movie, but I think you can't truly tell until you've seen it twice. Like, I think seeing First Reformed, once you know the ending, you can pick up on the breadcrumbs. You know what I mean? So where do you come on that sort of idea?
I didn't agree with that either. But she felt that her first hit on a movie was the defining one. But I think she was wrong.
How do you think being a critic helped, and then also a screenwriter before you even became a director, but how do you think that sort of helped you going forward in the filmmaking? Because a lot of directors have never done the criticism, and a lot of critics have never tried to make a movie, so it's so easy for them to pile on, and I just say, when was the last movie you made, bud? That's when I hate people get snobby about movies. But go try to make a movie first and then review a movie. But how much do you think the crossover there actually helped,
It doesn't help, it hurts. And you have to be very careful, because a critic is like a medical examiner. He wants to get that body on the table and wants to open it up, find out how it lived. And the filmmaker is like a pregnant woman, and all she wants to do is give life to this thing inside of her. So if you let the critic into the birthing room, he will kill that baby.
Good way to look at it. Well, to tie it all together, in closing with that analogy, maybe it'll be like the end of First Reformed, where the filmmaker is that pregnant woman coming into the church, and the critic is about to blow up that church, and together we'll embrace and we'll circle around it and circle this movie as a great movie. So that's the best analogy I can do.
I'll buy that.
Thank you, sir. Nice meeting you.